Welcome to Community Alert. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams, keeping you informed on how to get ready and be prepared. Tuesdays at 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. and Saturdays at 1 p.m. on AM 1290, the Santa Barbara News Press radio station.
Hey, folks, welcome to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. And today we have with us Dr. Glenn Millen. Glenn Miller, who is a psychiatrist here in Santa Barbara, always fun to have you on the show. Never know where it's going to go, but looking forward to it for
Thanks for having me.
Now put your seatbelts on. It's going to be a big one.
So, Mike, you got something for us?
Well, let's start off with a little bit of information back from the East Coast from the tropical storm. This is kind of interesting. There are 15 states impacted by the storm for a total of 510 evacuation shelters housing over 21,243 people. That's quite a few people. But when you think about the millions of people that live there and the impact of all the water and the things we're reading about just in Manhattan alone, that's a remarkably few number of people. So I thought that out of 510 shelters in 15 states, there's only 21,000 people being housed.
Well, the number of deaths I thought was really low as well, you know, looking at the millions of
people.
Well,
it may be that people took it serious. I have several friends in New Jersey who did not, and I have lost contact with all of them. So,
well, I was told that that was the most densely densely populated area in the country.
Yes.
Yes.
Along those lines, power outages. Connecticut has 31% of the entire state without power. New Hampshire, 20% of the state's without power. New Jersey, 62% of the state of New Jersey is without power. That's 2,498,447 people. I don't know how they know that down to the
47,
individual.
I thought it was
47, give or take. Somebody probably died and somebody was born in that, so that's probably inaccurate. New York, 21% of the state is without power. Pennsylvania, 20% of the state. And Rhode Island, 23% of the state is without power. Probably something a little more important, folks, here at home is airport conditions. All airports in Virginia appear to be open. New Jersey, Newark Airport is still closed, and in New York, LaGuardia is still closed. The rest of the airports appear to be opening with flights starting to depart at various times. You probably should check with your airline on that, but the airports are opening up quickly, and that's a good thing. Moving forward here, as soon as my phone starts to work, Santa Barbara Area Firefighter Expo, Friday, November 2nd, 4:30 p.m. at the Tennis Club of Santa Barbara, 2375 Foothill Road in Santa Barbara. This is hosted by the Santa Barbara Firefighters Alliance. Again, that's this Friday. It's free, and there'll be some munchies there and some tours and what have you. That's Friday, Tennis Club at 4:30. From Santa Barbara County Fire, Captain Dave Sadecki, Halloween safety tips. I encourage you to visit their website and check out.
Don't take candy from strangers.
Yeah, that's why you don't have any trick-or-treaters. Strangers, not strange people. Let's see, www.sbcfire.com. We're already in trouble, and I'm on the safety tips of the day. www.sbcfire.com. There's quite a bit of good stuff there to know. On a programming note, this next Tuesday we have a recorded show. This is the most amazing guest we've had on the show to date, aside from you, Doctor. Burke Bear, 13 years old from Tennessee, was here. We recorded the show last Friday. This is the most amazing kid. Anyone who thinks that we've lost our children and that our schooling is completely evaporated needs to listen to next Tuesday or to go to our website, wildlandresidents.org.
Of course, he is homeschooled. You know,
well, yeah, that's a good point. He talked about organic and sustainable farming and food products and sources. He's already published a book on this. He's already been on national television. He's been in at least, one or two films.
Mm.
This kid's amazing, and he looks like any other kid tweet-bopping down the road, except he's not watching television and wasting his life away. He has a plan. And
Well, he's inspired, you know,
yes.
And it's just really great to see.
But that'll be next Tuesday, 11 o'clock, but you can get it now at wildlandresidents.org. That's it with the announcements. Let's move into today's discussion. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule. You're hard to get a hold of.
Well, pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We were talking before the show about one of my great questions is how come you can't remember what you lost? Yeah, like your glasses and your cell phone and what have you. It was a George Carlin question because we were looking for some items here before the show.
Yeah.
That had escaped us.
Yeah. That had escaped us.
And one of us.
We're back. Let's talk today about death and the denial of death. This kind of goes back to the series that I wrote on emergency medical mm-hmm. services. There's no way you can talk about EMS in any capacity or medical care in any capacity and not talk about the reality of death. And it seems to be the thing that we talk the least and most about, even though absolutely everybody gets their turn. And so one of the books that I refer to is The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker, certainly not the only book on the subject. But we want to get into the issue of denial of death, as well as how death and the denial of it relates to the concept of heroism and how we put heroes out there as they challenge and walk in fine line, the death walk. And pilots have an old expression, cheated death again. You know, a safe landing is a good landing. That saying applies to probably a lot of people. So we kind of want to get into that. In the overview, how do you see death relating to our society in America today? Because we take it differently than most other societies do.
We do take death differently in our culture. Well, we take death is, I think, looked at differently in more modern advanced cultures. They are in some of the less advanced ones, where on the more advanced cultures, we can take very dramatic steps to try and prolong life, or if you would, support our denial of death. Whereas in more of the impoverished cultures, they're just trying literally to cheat death every day, to feed themselves, to keep themselves protected from the elements.
Are they really cheating it, though?
No, they're just staving it off.
Yeah.
But they're, you know, in underdeveloped nations, they have, every day is about surviving. For us, you know, in more advanced cultures, if you would, we don't have to think about survival every day.
The refrigerator is full.
The refrigerator is full. We go to work. We they're still hunting and gathering, if you would,
right,
in order to sustain themselves. So it is a different approach in this culture. And because we have had, over the last 60, 70 years, such incredible advances in medicine and in the ability to prolong life, that we start taking on an expectation that is, for the most part, still very unrealistic. It's interesting, I spent about a week and a half ago, I was in Chicago on for some family event, and my brother-in-law is an ophthalmologist, and because he's surgical ophthalmologist, he does a lot, works a lot of older people, and he's been in practice now for about 25 years, and he was telling me on this end that he can recall that 25 years ago when he was starting, he would have maybe one or two a month actual centurions, you know, people that are 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It was, you know, 25 years ago, which is, he says now he'll have two or three a week.
Interesting.
That are 100 or older, and many of them still living a relatively active, healthy life.
Now, there would be those that would argue, why are we investing, or better put, why are insurance companies paying for people to have ophthalmology surgery done in various capacities for someone that's 100 years old that's on extended time to begin with? And I'm not trying to be difficult. That's the question that we're having to ask.
We had that exact discussion, so it's interesting you brought it up. And my brother-in-law's comment was, if they just have a month left, okay, first of all, we don't know. You know, if you'd ask these people at 90 or their families, how much longer do you think they have? We'd all kind of look, wow, it's 90. Well, maybe a couple more, three more. Well, here they are 10, 11 later. So who's to really know?
Right.
Kind of thing. But that we are focused now on a quality of life.
Not okay? the quantity, but
not
the quality.
The quality. Personally and professionally, I've always been a staunch advocate that it's not about the days we spend, but it's how we spend the days, and it's about the quality of life.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. The United States Department of Health and Human Services recently released the statistics that the crude death rate in this country is 793.7 people per 100,000, and that's less than 2008, and it's reasonable to think that 2010 would be less than that. So obviously people are living longer, which then brings up the issue of quality of life, quantity of life, and what do we expect from that? And that's something I think, as we come back, we can kind of get into a little bit. We talk about our financial future. We talk a little bit about our health future, but what about our quality of life future? I mean, what do we have to look at? I mean, I look at people in these age brackets and I go, do I want to live like that? I'm not entirely sure. Talking today with Dr. Glenn Miller on the denial of death, Ted Adams, Mike Williamson. Watching the board for us today, Richard Dugan on Community Alert. KCSB AM 1290, your Santa Barbara News Press Radio, and live on the internet at newspress.com. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today we're visiting with Dr. Glenn Miller, psychiatrist here in Santa Barbara. We're talking about the denial of death and how that affects our culture. And that's just the beginning. Stick around.
Well, CBS News recently reported that Medicare provided $55 billion in payments for physicians and hospital expenses during the last 2 months of a patient's life. For perspective, this is more than the Department of Homeland Security and Education combined. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money. My sister's in the business. She says the amount of money and for product that goes out the door for people in the last 6 months is absolutely staggering. What the report from on Medicare and CBS goes on to say, it is reported that 20% to 30% of these expenses may have no positive impact on patient care. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, if you're the other 70%, then this
is a
good
thing. Really deny it to people because the statistics say they're not going to survive for a length of time. I think that's a good thing, actually, that we do spend so much on trying to assist and make more comfortable and to prolong the lives of our elderly. I think that what needs to happen is we need to have a better idea about some of the ways that we spend the money that aren't really necessary. I mean, to take someone's spleen out when they're terminal. I think there are some things that happen that the medical profession does simply because they can do it, and the health providers will pay for it.
Well, to be very honest, I agree with you that we need to care for our elderly, and especially towards the end of life. But what I am still chagrined about after all these years of practice in medicine is that we don't really allow the patient and the patient's family all of the options. To be in the decision-making.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
Because it is still, in most states, against the law to assist an elderly person who is still of sound mind that wants to make the decision that they don't want to put their family in incredible financial strains. They don't want to spend the last 2 months, 3 months that they may have left in a level of incapacity that is not consistent with what they've done their whole life.
I see a lot of that with friends of mine who have cancer. And in this state, fortunately, they can make the decision to turn down the treatments, which will make them incredibly uncomfortable, and 99% of the time will not prolong their lives. And they just say, no, thank you. I'd rather, enjoy my last couple of months.
But aren't those people that have prepared themselves psychologically, mentally, and emotionally for the inevitable versus the people who just all of a sudden it springs on them or they haven't prepared for themselves?
It takes all kinds.
They're much more at peace.
Yeah, I would think.
Much more at peace.
What baffles me is the you take the executive, the person that ran a Fortune 500 company, or he was a police chief, fire chief, mayor, he was the governor of a state. He was somebody of responsible charge, a person of stature. Maybe he was a TV personality or a movie personality, or maybe a dynamic radio show host like Ted and Mike. The bottom line, though, is
just like Ted and Mike.
Hopefully not. But the bottom line is that you reach your day when you're not anymore, and you're just like everybody else. And that has to be incredibly difficult for the folks that are type A personalities and narcissistic and a little bit neurotic to begin with to start to deal with that in its true reality. How do you address that?
Well, it does come down to ultimately an acceptance of the reality. I have said for years in talking with patients, talking with friends, that there's only two things that I've been able to come up with all these years. There's only two things that we as humans can absolutely all agree to. One is that death is, you know, inevitable. We only get a certain number of days on this earth. And the other thing we all agree with is that we don't know what that number is. Okay? But if we can get to a point, and usually it says we get older, and mortality does become something that we actually start planning for versus fighting against, that when that day, that number does pop up, we are more at peace because we have put things in order accordingly. You know, how many 19, 20, 25-year-olds rush out to get life insurance policies? It's not part of the thought process.
No. Okay?
But by the time you're 50, 60, you darn well have given it a lot of thought for a long time because that inevitability becomes part of what you do on a day-to-day basis. The denial of death is a fascinating concept in that, you know, there's a lot of theories about what we call gaper's block or rubbernecking at accidents. You know, why are people so fascinated by destruction or accidents or the potential for harm? And this is seen, you know, this is somewhat human nature. One of the theories is that because you haven't been injured, you weren't in that awful accident, you weren't in the car that just was totaled on the side of the road, that somehow you are quote-unquote safer because you've cheated death.
Well, you jumped ahead of me, Doctor, because that was one of my questions later in the show. I pulled this out of my article yesterday. Fires seem to attract all kinds of people, from the curious to the mentally ill. There are people who flock to fires like there's free pizza and beer. It seems strange, but that during a wind-driven wildfire, there will be more crowd control problems, not with the people trying to evacuate, but with the onslaught of people trying to get in to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And that has always, I mean, I can understand the onesie-twosie curiosity guy or the guy that's a photojournalist or what. I can understand all that. But the lookout fire, we had hundreds of people just standing around.
I don't think that we should be surprised by that, because I think that after talking during the lookout fire, here we had a relatively tiny fire, but it was the only game in on the West Coast, and so there was a tremendous amount of attention on it. And what I got a call that actually Mike deflected to me from public radio, and I talked to them several times throughout the day, and what they wanted was bad news. They wanted to know how many people's homes had burned, how many people had been hurt, how many homes were threatened. And this is what the public lusts for,
yes,
is this idea of the other, where they can witness a disaster. And I think it's exactly the point you were making, Doctor, that they can witness something that they're not involved in, and they can feel as if they dodged the bullet, or right, that they've actually been able to be on the other side, and how fortunate they are that they're not the ones that are actually involved in this mess.
Right, so, and that somehow they are just a bit more safe, a bit more protected,
maybe
a bit more fortunate, maybe a bit more watched over because it wasn't them.
Right, and I think that if more of them were, and this is kind of a bizarre, but if more of them were run down while they were standing out in the middle of the highway taking photographs of the disaster, which almost happened several times during this particular, they were, Highway 154 was closed down, but there were a lot of emergency vehicles and people on blind corners. They were found standing out in the middle of the street when the traffic comes around the corner, and they're all over the road trying to get out of these people's way, and the people have no idea.
Well,
and
so, how often driving down the freeway or driving down the road, there's an accident, and the gawkers, if you would, that are staring at end up having multiple car
reactions.
Absolutely. They've actually taken steps in England. They've implemented a new program where first responders to major accidents actually have with them, as part of their first response, screens that you can't see through that they put up around the accident site, and the initial data has shown that it actually diminishes the number of secondary accidents around accident sites to diminish the rubbernecking.
That's interesting. We ought to forward that literature up to the California Highway Patrol and Caltrans and see if there's some places we could play with that, because that'd be very interesting to see if that actually works here in California. Of course, that would require people to pay attention, and I'm not convinced that most of the motorists are paying any kind of attention. And with that hideous thought, we're visiting today with Dr. Glenn Miller, Ted Adams, Mike Williams on Community Alert, sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council, not if but when, positive preparation for disaster. On KCSB AM 1290, we'll be right back.
Hey folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. My co-host is Mike Williams. Today we're talking with Dr. Glenn Miller. As usual, very interesting conversation. Remember, we started out talking about the denial of death, and we've gotten off into a whole lot of different realms. Mike, I'll let you take it.
Well, I want to do a reminder here. Santa Barbara Area Firefighters Expo, Friday, November 2nd, 4:30 at the Tennis Club of Santa Barbara, 2375 Foothill Road in Santa Barbara, sponsored by the Fire Alliance, Santa Barbara Firefighters Alliance. I'd like to get back into the denial of death and heroism. One quote I had here in my last article, "To the public, our heroes are lifesavers and the robbers of death." Goes on, the first paragraph of this is a great book, The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. First paragraph of chapter 2, "The first thing we have to do with heroism is to lay bare the underside, show what gives human heroics its specific nature and intimacy. Here we introduce directly one of the great rediscoveries of modern thought, that all things that man moves, one of the principal ones is his terror of death." And we look at heroes, I mean, firefighters, police officers, military. To me, the real heroes are the school teachers and the physicians in the emergency rooms and the people in the streets. But aside from what your definition of a hero is, in the broad sense of the word, we've kind of categorized it into these large groups. What are we talking about here when we talk about denial of death and fear and heroism?
I'd just like to interject something. I believe that the heroes that we pay for are far different than the heroes that spontaneously rise to the occasion. And I feel that when you're talking about police officers and firefighters, they are trained, indoctrinated to respond in a certain way when they're faced with a death-threatening situation or a threat of death. Whereas the true hero, to me, is the person that spontaneously rises, and instead of the urge to flee from a problem, which is what's really built into us, they conquer that flight mechanism, and they go to the assistance of someone or something in order to save, and they completely forget about their own vulnerability, and they somehow conquer that and become a hero.
I would agree.
And to me, a hero that is paid the trained person in a war situation, the trained firefighter, the trained police officer, to me, that is more a given that they would respond that way in an emergency. Whereas the man on the street is a different thing, and that there's more heroism involved in that. My definition of what heroism is, Doctor.
Well, we're very blessed that we have so many types of heroes. And again, the school teacher every day is a hero. But you're right in that the person who chooses to dedicate their life to that kind of endeavor, whether it be police, fire, healthcare, medical doctors, you know, those of us that are working with the whole challenge of trying to cheat death for others, in a lot of ways, I believe that those people, and myself included, undertake that course because over time there is the, whether it's conscious or not, the sense that if we can beat death enough, if we can beat it back against the door enough times, we may be able to actually beat it ourselves. We may actually get enough skill that we can fight it off. the doctor who spends their days saving lives. Well, if we save enough, okay, maybe I'll get so good at it. Because if you think about it, in the other things we do, the more we practice it, the better we get at it.
So it's a psychological great lie.
It in a sense, it is. But thank goodness that there's those that want to try and perpetuate that denial.
Well, I had a thought here as you were talking. You have a physician, he's in the emergency room, and he saves somebody's life, whether it's, say, a cardiac arrest or something. You deal with suicidal people. You save lives, too, but in a different way. And it's curious to me, does somebody that's suicidal that you're treating as a patient, do they see death in a different way that it, to some extent, could be viewed as healthy for the rest of us to at least acknowledge that these folks have a different perspective? They're not afraid of it, at least not in the same way.
No, people that are strongly contemplating suicide, it's as an escape from an incredible amount of pain. You know, there are people with chronic pain syndromes. There's people, you know, elderly and not just elderly, that with chronic pain syndromes where a physical pain, where they just want to escape it and contemplate suicide. For those that have ever experienced the true depth of emotional pain that the human species can actually experience, it really is no different other than the fact that there's no relief. I know it's hard for those that have never experienced, but people with that level of depression actually have pain. It really is an emotional pain. And unlike most physical pain, where you could find that one position that if I just prop the pillow up this way, or if I just turn on my side that way, I can get relief for a little while. The ones with that depth of emotional pain can never find that even a momentary respite. And so it is those that contemplate or actually take their own lives, it's a very different reason than to just accept that that's going to be an inevitability down the line.
I don't know. My views of suicide are a little distorted, I think, because I've been around so much of it. And so to me, I see suicide as the ultimate sign of freedom. It's the only thing that you can really completely do for yourself. I'm taking away, of course, all the selfishness and all the other aspects of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not promoting suicide, don't misunderstand me. But I've seen it in so many different ways, professionally and within my family and close friends and whatever, a lot of it. And so it distorts my perspective of it a little bit, because not all of this was emotionally driven. Some of it was...
Well, some of it's accidental, like certain drug overdoses.
Yeah.
Which it's still suicide. I mean, it's still self-inflicted death.
Yep.
But in no way... intended.
Acetaminophen is a great example. I just went out and bought a bottle of acetaminophen, 275 tablets, 200 milligrams a pop.
Don't take them all at once.
No. And I'm thinking to myself, this stuff is highly toxic. If you were to take too many of them, like 10 of them at a time, you're done. You toast your liver. And then I'm thinking, well, who in the world would buy a container 275? And considering how safety conscious our state is, the nanny state that we have, why would they even allow you to buy that many of them?
Well, and acetaminophen, or you know, the trade name being Tylenol, is a very, not taken as prescribed, but is a very scary medication in the hands of young people. Because I've, when working in the emergency room when I was doing my training in psychiatry as well, it's you know, it's on TV all the time. Well, if you have a headache, just take your Tylenol. It's safe. It's effective. It's safe. It's not so safe. And that I actually had in the emergency room, I've had two young people that came in, and we knew that days later they were not going to be with us because it is incredibly toxic to the liver. And in this one case in particular, this young girl took an overdose of acetaminophen. She took 100 tablets. She took the whole bottle. It was a bottle of 100. Mm-hmm. Took 100 tablets in an attempt to kill herself. Went to sleep. Got up the next day. Was not successful. Was a bit disappointed, but just went to school. Okay. And 2 days later started throwing up. And 3 days later was in the emergency room. And 10 days later was gone because she had totally destroyed her liver.
Mm-hmm.
You only have a certain number of hours, a short number of hours window after ingestion of acetaminophen to give the antidote, which is something called Mucomist. And if you don't, And so these are intended, but then, if you would, accidental deaths by something that we're told is, quote, safe and effective.
Well, and we know that it, for sure that it's not. N.S. Shaler's book, The Individual, A Study of Life and Death, wrote, heroism is the first and foremost a reflex of terror and death. And that kind of reinforces what we're talking about here, that we're toying with death in so many different ways. And yet, at the same time, we're denying its existence by the way we live, by the way we drive, by the way we socialize with people, the kind of cars that we have, trying to give this constant usefulness. The plastic surgery business is probably 75%, if not more, towards the denial of death issues. As a society, have we become so obsessed with the inevitable that it's become unhealthy in and of itself?
We oftentimes take unhealthy steps in attempt to put off what absolutely is inevitable.
Yeah, because I don't see getting older. I mean, it has its obvious drawbacks, but I just don't see it as being such the negative thing that we, as a society, have built it out to be. I see older people, and they look beautiful to me.
Growing older sure beats the alternative.
As they tell us, yes. With that thought, Dr. Glenn Miller with us today. Ted Adams, Mike Williams, Richard Dugan on the board, Community Alert. Not if, but when, positive preparation for disaster. Talking today about the denial of death on KZSB AM 1290. Live on the Internet at newspress.com. We'll be back after these messages.
Hey folks, welcome back to Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams, my co-host is Mike Williams, and today we're talking with Dr. Glenn Miller, about the denial of death and how death plays a role in our social environment and the threat of death. And we're going to get back into something we started to talk about a few minutes ago, Doctor, about the flight and fight syndrome and how it affects us with the normal everyday person. And Doctor, I'd like to get your take on that, and we'll talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, certainly. There's a reflex that's within all of us called the fight or flight or fight or flee reflex, which has been a part of the human species. Actually, it's part of other mammal species as well, where and it is a reflex. It is something that is separate from conscious thought. Hence, it's called the fight or flight reflex, where when faced with a potential catastrophic event, we have a cascade of hormonal events take place in our body. There's an acute release of adrenaline, which causes us to then either flee from this potential catastrophe.
We most often flee.
Most often flee. Or to stand and fight and try and, if you would, dominate or be victorious over that potentially catastrophic event. Okay? And it's interesting that it's also what is at the basis of panic disorder. People have, if you would, a fight or flight reflex response. However, it's not in the face of an identifiable potential catastrophic event. But the experience they have inside themselves is as if they were.
So it's an anxiety, or is it an anxiety?
Well, anxiety is a difficult
term. Or is it something that comes
On spontaneously and immediately. It's, you know, the adrenaline, it's you know, walking down the dark street late at night and you hear a noise down the alley and that hair on the back of your neck and you kind of tense up a little bit and your hearing gets more acute, your vision gets more acute. That's the keying up towards that fight or flight reflex. And it is based on an immediate assessment of your environment. Walking down a street at 2 p.m. and you hear a noise down an alleyway, you turn casually and look and go, oh, what was that? Same scenario, 2 a.m. It's a very different physiologic response. Mm-hmm. So we have this cascade, this immediate release of a lot of adrenaline, which is very protective because it gets us breathing faster. So we start moving oxygen. It gets blood flow, it increases our blood pressure, getting more blood to our muscles, so that whether it is a flight response or a fight response, we are more physically, physiologically prepared to do either.
Well, you know, I'd like to expand on both what Ted said and what you're saying right now. As Ted was talking about the paid professional, firefighter, military, cop, whatever, and his not being necessarily a true hero because he's trained. And I think the training compensates and it kind of adjusts that fight and flight reflect to some extent, does it not?
Yes, it does.
So my perception of danger as a professional is going to be different than yours as a civilian.
And the reason, if we could just use the military as an example, or firefighters, mm-hmm. What do they do 99% of the time? They train. They train and train Correct. And train and train. Because when it comes time to be in that moment, they know, the powers that be know, that they are not going to be able, nor should they take the time to think.
You react.
They have to react. Okay? And the only way that you can react effectively in that moment is to have trained so much that it's part of your being. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because it is a reflex. It's a fight or flight reflex. There is no real ability to challenge cognitively to do it. So the training is, they go, well, we do this thousands of times. Yeah, then we're going to do it another 1,000 times until we get it right every time. Because when it hits the fan, you need to be ready.
Well, I think of a shooting situation as a great example of that, because the way a civilian responds to a confrontation with a weapon is different than a professional response to it. But it runs both ways. Because a professional is going to react, and they're going to react very quickly, and the results of which will be Monday morning quarterbacked for years. A civilian may or may not, and that's why I take some exception to some of the perceptions that are out there about carrying a weapon everywhere you go. Mm. How well do you train with that weapon? How well are you ready to deal with the confrontation in its totality? And how well do you even know how confrontations escalate and how they become threatening? And when do you have a real threat and when you don't? Even professionals have a problem with that, but when you're in it all the time, your sense of safety builds up.
One of the things I think that we're losing here a little bit, and that is the idea that all of these groups that we talk about are made up of individuals, and the individuals within that group, and when you're talking about professionals in law enforcement or in the fire department or whatever, that you're going to have the full spectrum of the reason for people doing things. Some people want to be heroes. They want to be, they're seeking to be.
Well, they create the situation.
They're seeking to be renowned mm-hmm. as heroes, and so they gravitate, and as you say, they create the situation where they can perceive themselves as heroes or be perceived as heroes. Mm-hmm. Then you have the person that's in a profession because they want to help people.
And some that want to cheat death.
And want to cheat death. And mm-hmm. so what happens is it's difficult when you start using generalities. No matter what group you're talking about, you're going to have the full spectrum within those groups. And that's why I have a difficult time with making generalities about groups, because there's all kinds of reasons for doing things.
Right. And again, there are the motivations behind, if you would, our heroes are multiple. They're so numerous we couldn't even begin to really
right.
put them all out there. But what's interesting is that once you get into that profession, again, military, firefighting, whatever your motivation was to get in, the training is the same for everybody. Because when mm-hmm. it all comes down to it, the why you got in is one thing. How you react, not respond, because remember, it's not about thinking. How you react in an acute fight or flight, if you would, situation is going to be, you can predict it much more effectively if you've had the recurring training.
Absolutely. It's like learning to play a musical instrument. All of a sudden, you play, and after training, and it's the same thing with personalities that are involved with disaster situations. You're faced with this scenario, you've done it a million times, and so you respond to whatever it is that you're trained in.
Well, and with doing that, you build up muscle memory, which is important with weapons and stuff, but also the issue of your perception of fear is much more finely tuned and calibrated to a form of reality because of your experience.
Right, and because of that, more, if you would, more the clarity in the in defining what's going on, you make better risk assessment. Mm-hmm. Is this truly a potentially catastrophic event? The layperson, you know, sees something and it's kind of like, oh my God. Okay.
Well, I think that I also think a great function here of the training is the team rather than the individual being faced alone with a problem, they are involved, they're in a brotherhood, or they're in a team, and so they have the support of those around them, and it happens in the military, it happens in law enforcement, it happens in firefighting. And with the man on the street doesn't necessarily have that team, and so that's even more heroics involved. Well, anyway, it's a different
thing. The other nice thing about training in muscle memory, all those things, is it also gets you to realize when there's danger that otherwise you didn't know about. And firefighting's a great example. Standing around in green brush when the wind shifts, firefighter's going to know not to do that. The public standing around oohing on the fire doesn't realize that in 10 minutes it's going to be there. Or the cop who knows that this particular group of guys standing on the corner are problematic and it'd probably be best to get away from them versus Joe Citizen who's just going to go in and buy his pack of cigarettes. Those are just two examples, but the world's full of those kinds of things. It's the experience that you get from training and the wisdom from experience, I think, factors in.
And that really is one of the big true differentiators between that momentary quote-unquote hero, the pedestrian on the street, versus the person or people that have chosen as a profession to be put in harm's way on a regular basis.
Yeah, well, and they might be more reluctant to inject themselves into a situation as a hero because of the situation, whereas the man on the street isn't educated about it, so he
really
throws himself into it.
Well, except for the funeral with the empty boot on the horse and everything, being a hero doesn't have a lot. I mean, it's wiser to go around the corner, call for help, get your reinforcements, and then come in with a plan. That way nobody gets hurt. But with that, we're with Dr. Glenn Miller today. Ted Adams, Mike Wins, talking about the denial of death. And once again, we're deviating into other areas. What a shame. Not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster on KZSB AM 1290, Santa Barbara News Press Radio, and the newspress.com. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the last segment of Community Alert. I'm Ted Adams. Co-host is Mike Williams today. We're talking with Glenn Miller, psychiatrist, about the denial of death. As usual with Dr. Miller, incredibly interesting program. We get so engrossed that next thing we know, it's the break, and next thing we know, it's time to go home.
You really need your own show. I just think that you could easily do a show, and I think folks that would really start to listen in, because when we take on a lot of the subjects we take on, we try to find out the question of why do people do that, or why do we want to do that, or why shouldn't we do that. We take on a little more of the humanistic aspect of it. Things aren't nearly as simple as we'd like to try to make them be, and there's a reason that people do some of the things. And why would we want to build systems and structures and bureaucracies that are contradictory to just human nature?
Well, we often wish you were here with us so that we could ask you questions. You know,
well, thank
because
you.
These are things that you know the answers to.
Well,
for folks that are listening that are interested in this, the definitive book, allegedly, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. It's available at Amazon.com and a litany of other places.
I actually read the book. It's an excellent book.
It's not a light read. This is not
No, it's not. But it is very
subject
informative.
Matter itself would deny
But if you want to start having answers to questions on the bigger picture, I think this is where you have to start. I mean, if you are a diagnostic person for an automobile or electronics equipment or whatever, you always start at the end and work backwards to find problems.
But solutions. Again, as the whole topic of today's discussion, the denial of death, it's not something that most people really want to address.
That's right.
Until
the less they know about it, more distant they have from it.
Right.
You know?
And it really only starts becoming addressed when the issue is close at hand.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, with ourselves or someone we love. Is
well, my exposure to it, obviously, was on the job. So I saw death in its horror. I saw death in its peace. I saw death in good situations, and I saw it in horrific situations. The military would be the same way. Physicians, mm-hmm. anyone working in an emergency room, you're mm-hmm. surrounded by it, directly or indirectly. It was amazing to me the number of people that came in conscious and an hour later were dead. It was amazing to me the number of people that came in pieces and walked home.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real rhyme or reason, and that's got to play on the minds of the people that are involved in it. And just in the last couple of closing thoughts, how do they deal with this kind of thing, the professional who's surrounded by it?
It has great impact on the professional surrounded by it.
It would have to.
It's when they're able to seek help in dealing with that that they can truly go on and continue to be the most effective professional in the human service provider profession.
Yeah, how do you go home and not take it with you?
Exactly. And how do you continue to go back every day and still do that job
sure.
and not take it with
well,
you?
Well, no one goes to medical school to kill people. I mean, that just doesn't happen. And yet, every physician is going to lose a patient. Mm-hmm. And they may lose a patient at their own hands. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be a tremendous burden to live with.
Well, and it is for the firefighter that isn't
yes.
able to rescue that child trapped in the building. And it goes on and on
oh,
and
yeah.
on. And it really is the ultimate sacrifice other than death that these professionals make every day,
and they have to live with it. And that's another story for another day, is living with the results. Thank you, doctor, for taking time out.
Thanks
as always
me.
It's been a great show. The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker, if you're interested. Ted Adams, Mike Williams next week, a recorded show. Burke Bear, 13 years old, fascinating. Until then, KCSB AM 1290 Community Alert. We'll be see you next week.
This has been Community Alert, not if, but when. Positive preparation for disaster with Ted Adams and Mike Williams. Community Alert is produced by the Wildland Residents Association, San Marcos Pass Volunteer Fire Department, and sponsored by the California Fire Safe Council. Technical support for Community Alert provided by Richard Dugan and Jim Williams. Community Alert, not if, but when. On KZSB AM 1290, your news press radio station.